The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 28, June 24th, 2006. Thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting started, I want to remind everybody the four ways to get in touch with the podcast. First is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, the website, thelemacoasttocoast.com. The voicemail is area code 206-600-4216, and via U.S. mail, Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, 30065. And that's in the U.S. On today's show, I'm going to be having a 20-minute interview with Keith about the Thelemic conversion process and things we've noticed in the Thelemic community. Also, I have an interview with Sam Webster. He is the founder of the open source Golden Dawn. But before getting into that, I want to talk about a few of the other things that are Thelema Coast to Coast related. Also go over listener email and voicemail and give away a Latex record CD. First, as I've mentioned in the past, there is a MySpace page for Thelema Coast to Coast, and over 500 people have friended it. So if you have a MySpace page and want to go over to it, go to www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast and make a friends request, and I'll be happy to add you to the friends list. Also, Thelema Coast to Coast has a Frapper map that can be seen on the front page of the Thelema Coast to Coast website. I want to thank the 230 people who have already signed up for the Frapper map. We have listeners all over the U.S., Canada, Europe, Australia, and other places. I noticed some of the listeners in Asia have not signed up on the Frapper map. So if you're out there, listeners, please take a moment and go to the Frapper map and list your location too. Now, I've been looking at some of the stats of the website since the beginning of the year, and I want to thank all the listeners. The website has had well over 1 million hits since January 1. And I specifically want to thank those who use the Thelema Coast to Coast banners on their website, their blogs, the profile pages, signatures, and so forth. I can really see the traffic generated from those. And if you have a blog or a website that you want to put the Thelema Coast to Coast banner on, please just go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website. There's a link on the right-hand side that gives you instructions and the code and everything to link directly to the banner. The banner is hosted on my website, so the traffic comes from my server. Please get the word out. Okay, also I want to thank the people who have been spreading the word about Thelema Coast to Coast and talking about it in their blogs. If you Google the phrase Thelema Coast to Coast, the whole phrase, it comes up over 12,000 times in Google. So clearly the word about the website and the show is getting out, and I appreciate that. As I mentioned, the last two shows, on June 6th, I had a meetup in Berkeley, California at Jupiter, and about a dozen people came, and I really appreciated it. Met a whole bunch of listeners and put some faces with names. Also had a number of the guests that have been on the show at the meetup. Keith418 was there, Jerry Cornelius, Eric Kaushin from the Temple of Set. There are pictures from the meetup. They are on the Thelema Coast to Coast website in the forum, so if you want to check that out, feel free to go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and go into the forum. Next, I want to go into listener email and voicemail. The first one is from a listener named Lisa. She writes, Hi, John. Thelema Coast to Coast is wonderful. I have really enjoyed listening to it. I discovered your show last week, and now I've listened to the first 23. As a tarot reader, I rely heavily on the systems, correspondences, and attributions that come out of the Golden Dawn and went into creating the occult tarot deck. Since I'm not part of a magical order, it has been insightful to hear people who are discuss their viewpoints. You also inspired me to looking into the English Kabbalah. Last weekend, I created a MySQL database and some PHP pages to calculate and compare systems. I'll have the link to that in the show notes. And she has a webpage that has a number of Kabbalahs on it that have to do with Nuyan English Kabbalah and other Kabbalistic systems. When you enter a word, it gives you the Kabbalistic value of words similar to it in the various systems. So thank you very much, Lisa. I appreciate the email and the interest in Nuyan English Kabbalah. Next is a voicemail from a listener in the UK.
Hi, John. This is Alex calling from England. Just want to leave you a quick voicemail to let you know how much I thoroughly enjoy the show. Love the interviews. Always look forward to interviews with Keith 418. Also, wanted to mention that I saw on Bishop Greenfield's website that it looks like he's left the OTO, or at least the OTO management. Wasn't sure if there's going to be any coverage of that in the show, but it certainly looks quite interesting, as his reasons for leaving seem to echo certain things that have already been said on the show. So, yeah, I thought that was very interesting. Hope the shows carry on. Hope you had a fantastic time at the meet in California. Obviously wasn't able to get there, but I hope you all had a wonderful time. And I look forward to the next podcast. Keep up the great work. Bye.
Thanks for that voicemail. I understand your interest in Alan's statement. I am well aware of it. Alan currently is in the process of moving and getting settled, so I will not be interviewing him about it in the next month or so, but it definitely has been something I've talked to him about, and we will be having him on the show about this in the near future, probably by the end of the summer. So thanks for the comments. Next is an email from a listener named Rick. 93 John, I just wanted to know if there were any tips for the solitary practitioner. I see certain advantages to the notion of a group will, but many local Thelemic bodies seem sporadic in their activities. Also, I've gotten the idea from various interviews with Keith 418 that he seems to think most groups, and hence most practitioners, are, well, posers. That people would rather wear cool robes and chant cool things and discuss cool stuff and in general be, well, cool. He's quite interesting, and I'm glad you feature him frequently, although I'm sure he pisses many people off with his blunt criticisms of the organization. I'm also glad you included his Nietzsche lecture on the podcast. He should do more of them. I had always figured there was a Nietzsche-Thelemic link, as both Nietzsche and Crowley seem to have a view vaguely aristocratic, but not an aristocracy of birth, rather of ability and inner dedication. Nietzsche definitely held that view, and the impression I got from Lawrence Sutton's biography of Crowley was quite similar. I have no idea where this egalitarian Thelema has its roots. Even in the Book of the Law, you don't really see that. Even if every man and woman is a star, it doesn't follow that every man and every woman are equal in ability or desire. Also, if Keith has a website, please let me know. Or if he has some books, I quite enjoy his outspokenness. 93s. Well, Rick, Keith does have a website. It is his blog, but he's pretty exclusive on who goes to it. It is on LiveJournal, so if you go to www.livejournal.com/Keith418, you will find it. However, you need to have a LiveJournal account and then friend it, and depending on if your LiveJournal is interesting, he might friend you back. He is very elitist about the whole idea, and if you're not interesting to read, he doesn't feel that you necessarily need to be reading his LJ. And I'm sure if I've got that wrong, he will correct me. So you can go check that out. He doesn't have any books out at this time. Also, there clearly is a Nietzsche-Crowley connection. Crowley quotes Nietzsche quite frequently. It would seem that you haven't read that much Crowley, because if you have, you would see that quite quickly. So I encourage you to go out and read his Magic Without Tears, Book 4, and the Commentaries to Liber All, Libra Aleph, etc. Now, regarding your question about the solitary practitioner and the dysfunction of the local thelemic bodies, I would have to disagree with you about the impression that Keith gives about the community. He does not give the idea that being a solitary practitioner is good because the local communities are messed up. He's saying that to really be an individual, you have to be in a community. Now, that may sound odd, but let me quote from a book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic by Philip Reif. From Plato to Aristotle, through Burke and de Tocqueville, the therapeutic implication of social theory is remarkably consistent. An individual can exercise his gifts and powers fully only by participating in the common life. This is the classical ideal. The healthy man is, in fact, the good citizen. So, if you really want to be a good practitioner, if you really want to be involved in your magic and be an individual, you need to be involved in a community. Now, that does not mean any particular organization. If you find that the OTO is not to your liking and that there are other organizations, that's great. Or even if it's just a loose group of friends or acquaintances that you do magic with, that's fine. But it's hard to do this kind of work by yourself. You certainly want to be very, very picky about who you do the magical work with. You just don't want to get with any group of idiots and start doing magic, especially if you're doing any kind of high magic. You never know what kind of circumstances will occur, and if you have somebody who doesn't know what they're doing in that environment, it can cause quite a problem. So you want to be very exclusive on who you work with, test them, ask questions, and so forth. But it's really going to be hard to do this kind of stuff by yourself. So I think you should start looking for a group to work with. If there's no organization around you, start putting ads out and start looking for like-minded people and build your own group. It certainly is a viable option, and it is something that really needs to be done if we want to move forward in our magical practices. So thanks for writing, Rick. Okay, the next voicemail is from a listener in her car.
Hi, John. This is Ella Faith in Santa Clara. I wanted to call in and let you know how I listen to the podcast, because I listen in my car, as you can probably tell by the background noise, and I suspect that by the time I get to a computer, go to the site, and enter the poll, I will forget. So I download the podcast using Juice, so it downloads automatically. I almost never actually remember to go to the site. And then I load it onto my Neuros MP3 player, which is infinitely superior to all the iPods people are using, and I listen to it in my car using an FM transmitter. So that's how I listen. Keep up the great work.
Thanks for the voicemail. I appreciate that. And thanks for the reminder. I am doing a poll about how people listen to the podcast. The podcatcher I see mostly in the stats is iTunes, so I appreciate you letting me know that you use Juice as your podcatcher. And if people could go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and fill out the poll in the top left corner, I'd appreciate it, because it lets me know how the podcast is being delivered. Okay, so as in previous shows, I have been giving CDs away from Latex Records. Kind of took a bit of a hiatus the last month or so on that, so I wanted to get back into it. A few shows ago, I played a song from Little Tin Box. The CD is called Action Music, and that CD is being given away to Richard in Charlotte, North Carolina. So thanks for entering, Richard. I will have this CD off to you in a few weeks. Also, at the end of the show, we will be playing another Latex Records album called Written in Ashes, and the song from that will be called Unfaith. Okay, well, that's the opening remarks from me. Today it wasn't too long, which is good. So let's get into the interview with Keith 418, and we will be discussing about the thelemic conversion process.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John. Thanks for having me.
In a previous podcast, you talked about or used the term crisis of conversion. What is this crisis of conversion?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at in a Thelema context, because it's something sociologists in the history of religion people tend to look at when they study religion, is the conversion crisis. Most of the people in the OTO were not raised in a Thelemic family. I think that that's fairly rare. Most of us were raised in families of other faiths or no faiths at all. So when we come to the OTO,
or we come, you know, into the Thelema community and become Thelemites, or recognize ourselves as Thelemites, depending on how you want to put it, there's a crisis that goes on between Thelemic values and the values that we used to have or that we're getting rid of. And you see this in every single major religious movement in the course of human civilization. You know, you look at Christians becoming Christians when they were once pagans or Jews in the Roman period. You look at barbarians who are becoming Christians in the later Roman period. You look at Chinese Buddhists becoming Buddhists when formerly they were, you know, involved in other indigenous Chinese religious systems. So all of this praxis and all of this sort of experience involves a crisis where you have to put away your old ideas and beliefs and accept these new ones. And one of the telling things in the Thelema community is it doesn't seem that people really recognize that crisis very readily. There aren't a lot of stories going around in the community about how, you know, people had this sort of road to Damascus moment or how they struggled with Thelema. It just seems to be something that isn't really the same kind of crisis or big deal that it is for people historically in these other faiths. And I think it's really important to look at this in terms of what Crowley himself went through. I mean, you and I privately talk about this a great deal, that if you study Crowley's own response to the Book of the Law, it was very fraught, it was very tortured, he tried to reject it, he couldn't accept it, he struggled with it for many, many years. And he writes about this fairly honestly and keeps saying that, you know, he did little tricks to try to change the words in the Thelemic canon that bothered him, that he tried to interpret things symbolically when, you know, rather than looking at their more obvious meanings because he didn't want to face the real implications of them. We don't really see people in the Thelemic communities having this kind of struggle. And what I've noticed is that when people join the OTO, for example, they sort of see their initiation not as a crisis or as a sort of new transformation, but instead as a sort of empowerment. You know, whatever you were before you were in the OTO, now you're a powered version of that. If you were a Wiccan, you go through OTO initiations, and now you're a power Wiccan. If you're a liberal secular humanist and you go through your OTO initiations, you're an empowered, you know, tougher, stronger liberal secular humanist. If you're a neoconservative Republican, then suddenly you're a power neoconservative Republican. And the idea that Thelema is going to seriously alter or change your previously held beliefs is not something that we see a lot of people coming to terms with. Now, in talking to a friend recently who was out here visiting me from the East Coast, you know, he said very bluntly that the less we see people talking about this conversion crisis, the more we basically can say to ourselves, well, they haven't really engaged in the material to any significant extent, because if they had, they would be having the same sort of crisis Crowley had about it. And you think to yourself, look at Aleister Crowley. If he approached the OTO and Thelema the same way most of the people that we know are, instead of becoming a Thelemite, he would just have become a power Buddhist, right? Because
right.
Buddhism was the religion that
right.
he was ascribing to when he received the Book of the Law. So this whole dynamic needs really a lot of study and a lot of examination. Why are people unwilling to really look at the crisis that Thelema offers them?
Well, I think this also kind of goes into the combination, the Thelemic this, the Thelemic Buddhist.
Right,
the Thelemic
right. I'm a Thelemic Wiccan. I'm a Thelemic Buddhist. I can do a half-assed version of Thelema and a half-assed version of Buddhism and put them together and somehow have a whole ass. You're not going to. In fact, it'll probably be more half-assed than either of the two half-assed things you were doing before that.
Why do you think this is happening? People just not really into Thelema?
I don't think many people really are. I think they're afraid of it. It's too difficult for them. The implications of it are too disturbing and too profound. And again, I mean, we're in a sort of interesting period, you know, in terms of our culture, where people think they're free already. They're not, but they think that they are. They're free to make their own choices. They're free to buy Coke or Pepsi. You know, they're free to take whatever low-paying job their education will give them. You know, they're free to marry, you know, whoever they want. And this sort of freedom that they have, you know, they think is Thelemic. So why would there be a major cultural or personal crisis around accepting Thelema when we're sort of in what they think is a Thelemic community already? This is one of the reasons why our leaders, for example, don't really have the same kind of critique of modernity and a critique of their times that Crowley used to. Crowley used to rage constantly about the civilization and the culture around him. He thought it had a lot of problems. Our current leaders, they're happy middle-class people. They think the secular humanist world is fine for them. They don't have any critique of it. If anything, they have a critique for Crowley and his perceived misogyny or racism issues or sexism. All of the little PC concerns they have are much more important in terms of Crowley than Crowley's critique of modernity. So consequently, how can you go through a profound conversion experience if what you're already experiencing is more or less thelemic?
Or you think it's thelemic.
Right, you think it's thelemic. And see, part of the problem here is that people don't recognize the totalizing aspect of the culture that they're already living in. And, we point this out a lot, that just because you don't see your society as being a totalitarian in the same way the former Soviet Union was or, Cambodia under Pol Pot was, doesn't mean that it's not a totalitarian society.
Well, what I find fascinating is when I talk to people about metaphysics and underlying ideologies, people actually look me straight in the face and go, but I don't have an ideology. Or, and I look at them and it's impossible not to have an ideology. Maybe you didn't choose one. Maybe you didn't consciously create one, but you have one. It was probably given to you by the society around you, your parents and your environment.
Right.
And
well,
it's so common sense, you don't even know that you have it.
Do you have values? Do you know what things are right and what things are wrong? Do things morally offend you? Do you get upset about things? All of these things indicate what your ideology is. And Gramsci, the Marxist thinker, points out that ideology is praxis. It's what you live your life doing. So if you live your life in a middle-class world, in a middle-class family, in a middle-class job, buying middle-class things and watching middle-class TV, your ideology is middle class because you couldn't participate in all of those things without a set of middle class values. And it's the same thing with lumpen values. It's the same thing with proletariat or working class values. It's the same thing with underclass values. It's the same thing with upper class values. You can't spend your life working in the ballet and say, I don't have any cultural ideology. Of course you do. It's around you all the time. You may not notice it. It may be so ingrained that you forget it. But you're like a fish that doesn't know what water is because you're surrounded by it all the time. Gnosticism and magic is about finding out what that water is. I mean, a magician or a Gnostic is really a fish that knows it's wet. So when people say that they don't really know, that they don't think they have an ideology or that the ideology they live in isn't totalizing or that the lemma hasn't created any problems for them, usually it's because they're fish who don't know that they're wet yet. And it's one thing when you have like first or second degrees in the OTO or new people that have some stupid ideas about this, because we all do when we're new. I mean, we're struggling with it. We're trying to get it. When someone's been in the group for 20 years and they still don't think that they have an ideology or they still think that you can be a Thelemite and a Buddhist at the same time and that's not going to create a problem for you, then that's just insane. And unfortunately, that's the situation that we have in the OTO right now. Most of our leaders, sadly enough, don't grasp these things. They haven't studied it. They haven't really looked at it. And they've made peace with the lemma in a way that fends off the inevitability of the sort of crisis that Crowley went through when he had to accept it. The other thing a lot of people think, and I see this all the time in talking to people, is that they're hoping their HGA experience is going to wipe out all the things in the Book of the Law that they don't like. When their HGA comes along, he's going to show them what things really are. And all the stuff they have a problem with Crowley about is going to go away. Well, that didn't happen with Crowley. When he had his HGA experience, he got a raft of stuff he didn't want to hear. Why do they think it's going to be any different for them? If they don't like Crowley, they don't like what Iwas had to say to him, how do they know that what their HGA is going to say to them isn't going to be a million times worse?
Well, probably what will happen is they won't actually go to have an HGA experience. They'll just pretend their imaginary friend from childhood is their HGA and live a secular humanist life.
Yeah, and they will never really be conscious of their ideology or anything else. And we see this all the time when people don't really know where their values come from. And even smart people just, they think it's just common sense. And magic and Gnosticism on its real level is understanding who you are. And that means understanding what common sense is. And the beliefs that you know about, that you're aware of, the ideologies that you can get a handle on, are usually not the ones that are powerful. The really powerful ones are the ones you don't see. And this is why one of the things that we like to do is talk about class issues a lot, because class in America is like dark matter. No one sees it, but its gravitation determines everything around it.
Right, and it's another thing that people deny exists.
Right, and they don't want to look at, they don't want to, you know, one of my friends was pointing out that middle-class people, you know, Poussel points this out in his book, middle-class people don't want to talk about class because it makes them nervous. And the OTO members who are middle class don't want to talk about the fact that the middle class really runs the OTO right now, or the leadership cadre is predominantly middle class, or that middle class members of the OTO seek to impose a middle class, you know, humanist or egalitarian democratic ideal on the rest of the OTO, whether they realize it or not, because that's what common sense is. That's what the good is to them. It's not examined. They don't think about it. They certainly don't consider Crowley's critiques of it. What did he know? You know, he was a misogynist. He was a terrible person. Look at all the bad things he said. That means we don't have to listen to him. We can do what we know is right. And what we know is right is really being determined by the practice and superstructures of the world that we live in, not the world we create consciously, but the world we sustain as we just go about our lives, buying our stuff, working our jobs, having our relationships, doing our crap. And this is what, you know, you and I, if we can ever achieve anything at all, will be to get some people in the OTO to start looking at this stuff and realizing just how determined their reality really is, so that they have a chance at changing it. Because you can't change things you're unaware of. And if the OTO is struggling with a lot of this stuff, if the larger Kalima community is struggling with a lot of this stuff, and I think the larger occult community, the pagan community, whatever you want to put it, I think they're all fighting with this stuff. If you don't know what you're fighting against, you can't get anywhere. And the saddest thing I think both of us have observed are people struggling with this stuff and not even knowing what they're fighting with.
Right. And to actually know what they're fighting with, people are going to have to do the work. They're going to have to do the reading. They're going to have to make a lot of effort to do this.
Right.
It's
and
easy.
Part of that effort is accepting things that are difficult to accept. I mean, one of the questions that we get a lot is that people find that the books are hard to understand. Well, there's complex things that are hard to understand, and there's easy things that are difficult to accept. The Book of the Law has got complex aspects, and the Thelema Cully books have complex aspects, but the hardest things in them are often not the most complex things or the most difficult to understand things. They're the hardest to accept things. And things are hard to accept for us because they go against our ideas of goodness and fairness and equality and justice, and all the ideals that we're born into in a world that is created and sustained by people using those ideals to go about their lives and do their business. So initiation is really getting free of those ideals, which is going to look diabolic and mean and crazy to people sometimes, just the way you and I look mean and perhaps crazy to people sometimes.
Right, and strict and cruel and uncaring.
Yeah. Right, and uncaring and unfeeling, because we have to be all of those things sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, in order to break through the bonds that are created around us by a society which is imposing its viewpoint on us in a very, very uncompromising way. Yeah, we want people to look at this, and we want people to have a conversion crisis. I mean, I would love to see people really being honest about the stuff that they're having trouble with, or the stuff they had trouble with and overcame, rather than, this is my rationalization that I use to make sure that Thelema really means equality for everybody, or that Thelema really means that I have to be concerned about what happens to poor people.
And people should understand that you and I are still dealing with this problem.
Of course.
Why
would we be talking about this or even working on this if we weren't still dealing with it?
Right. I mean, there are times, you know, that I struggle with trying to live a Thelemic life, because I still have so many of the normative values deeply ingrained in me. And when I do things that I interpret that are Thelemic, that go against the norm, I feel an internal struggle about it.
Oh, yeah.
It's not easy for me.
Right. It's not easy at all. And ideally, our community is there to help reinforce Thelemic values for us, not to reinforce societal values. And this is the great crisis of the Thelemic community, is that it doesn't have enough people in it yet who are really Thelemites to reinforce Thelemic values. So it winds up sort of being divided against itself. I was reading a novel yesterday that quoted Kierkegaard as saying, "Despair begins with the division of the will." And when your will is divided between trying to serve two masters, the normative world of Judeo-Christian-influenced secular humanism and bourgeois normative values, which determine the world most of us live in, or the values of Thelema and Aleister Crowley, who was totally opposed to that world and those values, you know, you're in despair because the will has been split. And that's one of the reasons why I think the OTO is in many ways such an unhappy community, and why it's in denial, and why it has all these problems and these crazy issues keep coming up, and there's a great deal of human tragedy mixed up in it that, that people who are longtime members are well aware of: murders, suicides, early deaths, people suffering from insanity. These are not happy-making things. They're very unhappy-making, and I believe that they come from this essential division of the will. People are just completely confused and torn between a thelemic set of values and a normative one.
Where do you think people should start if they really want to address this?
Well, I think they have to start by not kidding themselves anymore, and sort of turning on their bullshit meters, if you'll pardon the expression, and really examining what the implications of what Crowley was writing about was, and not dismissing it. I mean, one of the ways people think that they can attain is by putting Crowley down. It's not really worked that well. There have been hundreds and hundreds of people in the thelemic community over the last 25 years who haven't liked Aleister Crowley. Very few of them have done anything that's going to matter to us, you know, at all. So being honest about the problems that Crowley is talking about and seeing whether or not he's really wrong or we need him to be wrong in order to support a competing set of values, I think is the issue. You know, reading the books, immersing yourselves in the material. I mean, I've been very frustrated lately with a lot of people coming to me, asking me for help, asking me for teaching, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, look, go and read the books. You have to immerse yourself in the material. Study the books, read the books. If you don't understand something, work to understand it. And that to me is where it starts. If you're not reading the books and you're not deeply involved with them, then you're not really going to get anywhere with this. If you think it's something you can pick up from people who are just as deluded and ignorant as you are, forget about it. And unfortunately, that's how most of the people in the OTO seem to teach each other. They don't go and read Crowley. They find out, you know, what it's all about from talking to the other people that are just as dumb as they are. Not a good plan.
There's a quote that you talk about from the Jane Wolfe biography.
Which one you're talking about.
When Jane Wolfe showed up at Cephalu and started asking Crowley questions, what happened?
Well, he told her, go look at the books. The answers to the questions you have are in the books over there, and he'd point to the bookshelves. And this got her very upset because she had been living what she claimed later was a shallow and superficial life in Los Angeles, making stupid movies in Hollywood, had not been reading, had not been studying, and had not been around people that told her she had to get off her ass and actually read stuff. And so for a long time, Crowley had to teach her logic and reasoning and make her read the books. And she said later, I was an incredibly obnoxious pest because I wouldn't do the work that he wanted me to, and I thought that I didn't have to. And I read this, and I was like, wow, this is like so many people in the OTO. You know, even if the ones that are not living in Los Angeles, they didn't need to go to Los Angeles. Los Angeles came to them. Modernity is Los Angeles. So they're all living in this superficial, ridiculous world of computer games and blah, 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 and stupid movies and science fiction crap. And now suddenly you and I are saying, hey, you've got to read these books. And they have the same reaction a lot of time that Jane did. They don't know logic, they don't know reasoning, and they won't read. And what's really interesting to me about the Jane Wolfe passage is Crowley is considered one of the major irrationalists of the 20th century. And he was somebody who constantly put down the idea that reason was the great salvation, or that reason was what was going to get us out of our problems. Yet at the same time, he knew he had to teach Jane logic and reasoning. And don't you find it appalling that so many people, even so many smart people in the OTO, seem so logically impaired?
Yes. It you can't have a discussion with someone if they can't follow a set of arguments. Because if they can't go from A to B to C to D to C to conclusion, what's the point of having the conversation?
Right. It's just all scattered and emotional and what they feel at the time, and it's all contradicting itself. And, you know, you and I have had this experience over and over again where we've watched people contradict themselves in the course of one, you know, internet discussion. You know, two or three posts down, they're going to be contradicting what they said two or three posts up, and they'll keep doing it, and they won't remember anything they've said, and they resent being held to what they've said. You know, I think both of us have been accused of holding people's words against them, which I always interpret as, you know, actually taking you seriously and showing you the implications of what you said.
Right, and paying attention to what
they said. Oh, you're trying to turn my words against me. No, I'm trying to show you how you're not being logical. So, yeah, that's that's the basic thing. And look at those weaknesses and say, hey, you know, this is serious. I need to learn how to do this. And logic and reason are things that can be overcome, but you don't overcome them by being bad at them. I have not overcome figure skating by the fact that I cannot figure skate well. You don't overcome driving by not being able to drive. You overcome your problems by mastering them and then moving on.
Right.
And most of the time, the people in the OTO try to parlay their own suckiness at something as overcoming.
Well, this reminds me of a quote that Salvador Dali said, learn to paint like the masters, and then at that point you can paint any way you want because you have the skills and you know
exactly.
the rules and you can break them.
Exactly. And look at what a genius Salvador Dali was, because he could paint if he wanted to with all the rules like a perfect master, and instead he began bending them, and he's a genius. Whereas most of the people in the OTO think they can be like Dali without ever learning to do the basics. And that's just not, it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen in magic. It's not going to happen in argument. It's not going to happen in Gnosticism, and understanding the way the Gnostic Church works, in understanding Masonry, or any of the things that are really important.
Is there anything else you want to say? We're getting towards the end of our time segment here.
Well, you know, I would encourage people. I know that oftentimes you and I sound very dour and very strict, but we're doing that to counterbalance the sort of euphoria of the beginner book mentality, where you don't have to know a lot to be able to do this. And I just unfortunately think that that's not true, that you do have to work hard, you do have to learn a lot. It's not easy, but I still, that doesn't mean I want to discourage people. I think people should work on this. I think nothing in a lot of ways is more important than this. I don't think people should kid themselves or lie to themselves about the cost and the sacrifices and what it's really going to take.
Well, thanks again for being on the show, 93.
Thanks for having me, 93, John.
Thanks again to Keith418 for being on this show and talking about these important subjects. I don't know really anybody else who's kind of addressing these aspects of the magical practice, so I hope the listeners really enjoy this. Now we're going to move into an interview with Sam Webster. He's the founder and operator of the open source Golden Dawn. They're a Bay Area organization that has taken the Golden Dawn rituals published by Rigardi and have started working with them and modifying them, and have a group operating in it. Known a number of participants in the open source Golden Dawn, and they speak very highly of it. So, and based on the recommendation of two listeners, I contacted Sam Webster and asked him to be on the show. So here's the interview.
We have on the phone with us Sam Webster from the open source Golden Dawn. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Glad to be here.
For those who are not aware, can you give a little background about what the open source Golden Dawn is?
Sure. The open source Golden Dawn is an approach to the classical Golden Dawn material, mostly through the Stella Matutina versions of the rituals that we get from Israel Rigardi, updated a little bit through the material that Pat Zawiski now makes available to us. But since the stuff was published before I was born, we've taken an attitude that makes secrecy with regards to the content of our rituals and such not relevant. We don't publish our membership, but in general we make our versions of the rituals available and make ourselves publicly visible. Another piece to it, which is part of the open source-ishness of it, is that we recognize that these rituals are editable. If someone actually understands the basis for those rituals, why they are the way they are, how they work, and so forth, well, there's some problems with the older forms that either conflict with current culture, or sometimes it's just a language issue. They'll use the term peculiar, where we would use the word particular, and it just sounds wrong nowadays. So minor things like that, more major things like we try to minimize the top-down hierarchical quality that was very present, left over from Masonry, not inappropriate there, but we didn't find it helpful. And more importantly, we wanted to integrate Salima more extensively into it. And Yahweh is not exactly a friend of ours. We're pagans mostly, so we needed to be able to move Yahweh out of the stream and return the Golden Dawn to its more fundamentally pagan foundation.
Okay. Because the Golden Dawn had the Masonic hierarchical structure, and you guys, within the the open source Golden Dawn. You've kind of changed that a little. Can you describe how the organization is administered and how the initiation processes work?
Sure. I'm also a Master Mason, so I've become kind of familiar with, and I deeply respect and enjoy the process within the Masonic Lodge, which is very much on the basis of the command of the Worshipful Master and the relay of commands down the chain of command to perform the activities of the hall. However, many years ago, when I was first looking at these rituals with the thought of redacting them, there were problems with the kind of hierarchical structure in the sense of the command structure. Frater Carrick, you have my command to declare that the hall has been opened. Little things like that. What I found amongst pagans and amongst many of my colleagues in general was that always grated on us. We were there because we wished to be. We were there in a cooperative attitude. And while, frankly, my experience of Masonry has sort of backed me away from this, it nonetheless turned out to be a very useful approach driving forward to remove those things. So we use things like please, mm-hmm. and would you, and so forth, and will you, which constantly gives the officer who's hearing this the opportunity to say, I will,
Got it.
Refocus around the aspects of will that are being articulated in the drama that is the ritual.
Okay. What about the organization? Is it still in a hierarchical structure, or is it more...
To some extent.
Okay.
We're only 5 years old now, I think. Yeah, it's about five. Yep, 2001 is when we got started. And so it was necessary from the beginning to depend this on myself, which wasn't something I was very comfortable with, but I saw no way of accomplishing it. Most of the groups that I've either been in or formed were consensus-based or very non-hierarchical. Maybe someone would sponsor things, but there was a very peer kind of relationship. In this case, however, the group of people who assembled to found this order wanted to go forward but didn't have the experience with which to provide guidance. Well, I had to take on that hierarchical role. But the proviso was, when we came up with seven full adepts in this, we would then move to a democratic framework where the College of Adepti would elect a president who would then run the organization. Having been trained as a minister and having served in a variety of other different leadership positions, I take an attitude that if I tell somebody to do something that they don't want to do, I'm no longer a leader. And so we have worked to build into our system the checks and balances, the flows of information up and down the chain that keeps things as much on the level as we possibly can. And as we transmute the organization from a slightly hierarchical one over the next several years to a fully democratic one, even that will be minimized further. However, in ritual, you still need a captain. You need somebody to say, we're starting now, very much like a conductor of an orchestra, and somebody to call the beats, as it were. So there's an instrumental quality that needs to remain in ritual, but at the organizational level, there needs to be a clear sense that we're a bunch of adults in America working together to further ourselves on a spiritual path. And with that, the hierarchy actually gets in the way.
Okay. How is advancement determined within the organization?
Very simply and along traditional lines. There is, for every grade, there is a batch of material that was published in the original Golden Dawn books as knowledge lectures.
Mm-hmm.
We have taken those knowledge lectures, they're up on our website, and from them we've derived a very simple test. There's the PDF file for the test is right there on the site. And what people tend to do, particularly if they're not already richly familiar with the material, but also as a pretest, they download the thing, they pretest themselves until they're ready, and then they take the test in the presence of a proctor who assures us that the person taking the test has not had recourse to materials,
mm-hmm.
because it has to be done from memory.
Okay.
And when they pass that, then they arrange for a conversation with their hierophant, which for the last number of years has been me, And we discuss the meditations, and I can pretty well tell whether or not the person's actually done the meditations from that conversation, and discuss how the order is working for them. This is one of the opportunities that, say, in a traditional, say, Japanese society where you have a formal master-student relationship, one of the ways, like in a Taiko group I know, the master is teaching his second, the second is teaching the third all the way down until the newest person demonstrates what they're learning to the master. And that way, the master determines whether or not the lesson is getting the full way around. So when I interview people, I'm also, for these between-grade conversations, I'm also finding out how well the educational process is working. Part of my, I have a Master of Divinity, so part of my advanced degree is in religious education. And so I'm constantly testing to see how well our educational process is working for every individual, and every individual has their own educational needs. But through this conversation, I find out how well we're doing.
Okay. Where did you get your Master's of Divinity?
My final degree came from Thomas Starr King School for the Ministry, but I also got to study at the Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago, the University of Chicago Divinity School, and the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago.
Excellent. Okay.
I highly recommend that kind of degree. The Master of Divinity is the degree for a minister,
mm-hmm.
and it teaches both, it teaches history, which is incredibly valuable because most of us have not been told the truth about religious history in the West. It teaches how to do theology if you go to one of the liberal schools, like the Unitarian schools I went to, as opposed to a set of doctrines. Many people think theology is a set of doctrines. It's actually a mode of practice. And the most important thing is that it teaches how to be a minister, which most people cannot do properly. In the same way as a psychologist has to be trained properly, we have to get over the desire and the drive to try to fix people, and that means we have to be broken of that. So we go through the clinical pastoral education process, which sits us down with the dying, with the truly psychologically damaged, often organic problems, and with the massively ill. And by having to just learn to be human with them rather than, oh, I'm the expert, I'm here to fix you in some way, we then learn how to truly meet that person and use the one thing that actually heals, which is relationship and our presence.
Great.
Makes us much better leaders.
How do you incorporate Thelema into the open source Golden Dawn material?
We take the concept, Rahor Kuit has taken his seat in the east of the Equinox of the Gods very seriously. And to a certain extent, you might say that we're an experiment in, okay, if this stuff is coming out of a Golden Dawn framework, some people see a conflict between the Golden Dawn and Thelema. I can't make sense of what they're saying. I've never seen that conflict. We are back-crossing, as it were, Thelema into the Golden Dawn out of which it arose. And as such, we put Rahor Kuit on the seat of the east rather than Osiris. And as such, the hall in its inner side changes. The way the Golden Dawn saw the Hall of the Neophytes, it was as the weighing of the heart, the judgment of a dead soul. As a student of Egyptology, I've never been able to find any evidence that that was actually used for initiation. And when we put Rahor Kuit instead of Osiris in the east, it changes the entire flavor of the hall. And so instead of doing the weighing of the heart, which might be appropriate to a dead person, we see the task of initiation in the Neophyte Hall at the symbolism level of bringing a new crewmate onto the Bark of Ra. Rahor is at the helm of the Bark of Ra. And we're all on the journey towards the West, the great journey of life, the great journey of aspiration towards apotheosis, to we bring somebody on to join in that journey and to help move us all in that direction. So it changes the flavor, even though the ritual, in a very real way, doesn't change much of its outer quality. But it shifts.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not, you know, judging a dead person.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because Horus has moved now from the west to the east, we needed somebody else to put in the west. And we put his twin brother, Set, in the west.
Interesting.
Yeah. It turns out that the two of them in Egyptian theology are mostly considered a balanced pair. And as such, the two of them work very, very nicely together. Set is actually the protector. He's Diferen Horne Jeti Ra. He's the giver of the name of Horus and the protector of Ra. In the traditional Amduat story, the story of Ra going through the land of the dead, Set stands at the prow of the boat, and when Apep arises to attempt to prevent the dawn, it is Set that beats back Apep with his great spear. So, perfectly appropriate for the Hieris role within the Golden Dawn framework.
Have you integrated any other systems into the open-source Golden Dawn material?
We have. The Buddha Dharma. Buddhism, by most people's terminology. There's a variety of different approaches to Salima. Some take a very mammalian dominance paradigm. We tend to see it in a tantric framework and see the stamp down on the wretched and the weak in a tantric light, which, if one studies tantric imagery, is actually very common, and it has to do with the destruction of the aspects of existence that we will want less of.
Okay.
Rafa Kweet, as Buddhist symbolism go, is actually just mildly wrathful. If you look at some of the stronger forms of Vajrasattva or such, it's way more wrathful and destructive. But that framework, we find, corrects a number of problems both in the Golden Dawn and the Western magical tradition in general. The principal one being the term that the Buddhists use called bodhicitta, which is we do this for the benefit not merely of ourselves, but for the benefit of all beings. That's why we strive to attain. So we've taken in a number of tantric practices and woven them into our work. First off, we take refuge before beginning. Not so directly into the Buddha, but into we take refuge to all those beings who have ever attained and thus vowed to help anyone who asks. And we receive their help and then wield that help in our work. At the end of what we do, we dedicate the merit. And this turns out to be one of those really useful little tricks that the West hasn't picked up on yet. Many people, when practicing quote-unquote ceremonial magic, or even Wicca, or varieties of paganism, will discover that at the end of a ritual, there'll either be kind of a giddy feeling or sometimes a bitchiness comes out. And that's partly because of the ego inflation that arises from us taking on god forms and a variety of other things, charge and such. Now, Wicca has the advantage of often throwing a cone at the end of a ritual, so that reduces the overall energy. But in a Golden Dawn-type ritual and other such that don't use that kind of approach, the energy is still there. The charge remains. But by giving it away, giving away the charge, by dedicating it to the benefit of all beings, we then put it away at the same time as we're putting it in our back pocket. So it's this weird thing of giving it away yet not losing a bit of it, and nonetheless storing it such that we don't have this kind of conflicts and giddiness and silliness that arises afterwards. Instead, the energy backs down very gently. The ego deflates very gently without the kind of conflicts that arise. And it just keeps adding more and more charge to the process.
Now,
useful.
Do you also have a refuge ritual and a merit transfer ritual?
Well, we use a technique from the Dzogchen community for refuge, that is the sounding of the syllable ah three times, just ah. And the first one is the prayer for asking for help. The second one, with the sounding of that ah, it's as though all those beings now beam back ah at us, and we imagine ourselves being filled up with the empowerment that they offer. And with the third ah, we then share that help with all beings.
Okay.
At the end of our ritual, we have a dedication verse, which goes like this. May the benefit of this act and all acts be dedicated unto the complete liberation and supreme enlightenment of all beings everywhere pervading space and time, so mote it be. May the benefits of practice, ours and others, come to fruition ultimately and immediately, and we remain in the state of presence. Ah. And we do one final long ah together.
Okay. Where is the open source Golden Dawn out of?
Well, the open source order of the Golden Dawn is principally here in the Bay Area.
Okay.
Our main temple is in Richmond, the hills above Richmond, where the Liberty ships were built. But we've got a temple up in Seattle, and we've got a temple in Manchester, England.
And but to take initiation, people actually do need to show up. It's not a, an astral or self-initiation?
No, we don't do astral initiations. We suspect it may be possible to do them, but for a couple of different reasons, we don't want to do that. One, we want to know who we're working with to the best of our capacity. We also feel that the process of actually showing up, meeting the organization, going through the process physically has much more important and valuable impact for the aspirant than what we could do at a distance. And self-initiation is a perfectly valid approach towards this work, but it's very different to be the audience of one in a drama for one's benefit, and the impact on the levels of body, speech, and mind for the aspirant is very, very different.
If somebody wanted to get in touch with you all, how would they do so?
Well, we have contact information on our website, which is at www.osogd.org, standing for Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn. And there's a Contact Us button, and our Cancellarius address is there. And just put in a request, and then we start the conversation.
And what is the process for joining?
Well, first one writes to our Cancellarius and says, "I want to join." Our Cancellarius says hello and writes you back with a very simple questionnaire, which gathers a little bit of information about your past and your intent, and then we meet somewhere. If we've actually met the person before, we might meet in a home, but most of the time we meet at a local coffee shop and get to meet the person, find out their quality from that conversation. There's a small membership committee that does so, and we have a conversation for a couple hours. In that process, we can pretty well suss out whether or not this should go forward. Assuming that it does, actually what we do is say, "Thank you very much. It's been lovely chatting with you. Now we're going to talk about you behind your back. We invite you to say goodbye." And we shuffle them out of the coffee shop and then discuss our experience of that person, assuming it went well. Then we do something that is somewhat unusual amongst orders. We actually invite the prospect to come visit us in lodge when we are going to open up the lodge, often when we're going to be initiating another person. So they have the opportunity to see what the initiation is that they're going to go through before they actually have done so.
Now, why do you do that?
Well, there's no good reason not to. And we've discovered that the person going through the initiation has a radically different effect than a person just observing it.
Okay.
And part of our open source approach is to make this stuff available so that you can see what you're going to be dealing with. And we also have the opportunity then to see how that person behaves in ritual and get to use all the resources that are available in ritual to scope them out. If they behave well, if their energy is coherent and harmonious with ours, then we, after they've gone away, we as a group discuss them, and assuming there are no objections. And we do this on sort of the Masonic framework. If somebody objects, we listen very carefully, and if they don't withdraw their objection, the odds of that person getting initiated are very poor.
So even though there's an open source kind of peer aspect to the organization, there still is a selectivity of who can and cannot participate in it.
Very much so. Partly because we publish our rituals. Anyone is welcome to go and create a group and run those rituals on their own. And we have no control over that, nor do we seek control over that. If they want to work with us, on the other hand, then we get very, very selective. We feel that discretion at the intake is a vital portion of our work. And because of this, we have an intensely harmonious order. Our people care deeply about each other. We work very well together. We very, very rarely have conflict. And when we do, most of the time, we're able to actually resolve the conflict, and it ends. And we've had a few times when we couldn't do that, but for the most part, we can.
Is there any other financial obligation required from participants?
Pretty trivial. The order as a whole does not charge any kind of dues. But our local lodge decided, partly to pay for the website, to pay for raw materials and so forth, to charge a dues of $5 a month or $60 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, we end up with a nice kitty to be able to continually improve our lodge hardware and and get the resources we need and occasionally sponsor a project or two.
Okay. Thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate your time.
I'm deeply honored that you would ask me. Thank you for being in touch.
Okay, well, that does it for show 28. I hope you all have enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed talking to Keith and Sam. They were great to have on the show. And as I said earlier, the outgoing song is Unfaith, written in ashes, published by Latex Records. So thanks again for listening. Hope you tune in for the next show. It should be out in about 2 weeks, and it will be featuring an interview with a gentleman named Breck Outland talking about Crowley's student, C.F. Russell. Until then, love's the law, love under will.